Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com. accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast coming to you from Montecito, California. Today, I want to talk to you about self-storage. Okay, for those of you who have participated in our self-storage offerings in the past, with Reliant Real Estate in particular, we've done some joint ventures with them. You know that you can make a lot of money in this space, okay? One of our deals was not planned this way, but nearly doubled investor equity in just under a year. I think it was like 9-10 months. Now, those kinds of returns are, you know, are sexy, but self-storage itself is not sexy at all. And by the way, those, you know, past performances not dictate blah, blah, blah. You know all that stuff. But the point is, self-storage itself is not sexy at all, but can be very profitable. It's just, the thing is, it's boring. It's where people keep their stuff when there's no room for it in the house. But in times like these, boring isn't so bad. In fact, when it comes to business, boring is actually a very good quality for sort of the all seasons business cycle type thing, right? Self-storage facilities have historically shown resilience during economic downturns. And unlike, you know, some other real estate investments, they often experience a steady demand even in challenging economic conditions. People, you know, they downsize, they relocate, they lose their jobs, have to sell their houses, seek temporary storage solutions, stuff like that. Everyone needs self-storage, right? Whether in urban areas, whether you're living in smaller or in smaller areas or suburban large areas, rural areas, whether it's for personal use, business use. And from the standpoint of the owner of these facilities, self-storage takes advantage of one of the major characteristics of mankind, and that is inertia, right? Inertia. In other words, do you have stuff in storage? I do. How badly do I want to move that stuff to another storage facility if someone charges me an extra $10 per month to keep it there? Not nearly enough. Not nearly enough, right? That is inertia. I just don't want to do it. And that's why those rents keep creeping up over time without losing much money in the way of occupancy. It's a great business model if done well, if it's executed well. Now, Reliant Real Estate is one of the nation's top operators in this space. And it's done it for several years. And although I am not partnering with them on their current fund, which is Reliant Fund 4, you can find that at ReliantFund4.com. I am investing in it and I'm promoting it because I think it represents a really good opportunity with minimal risk. Now, this week on Wealth Formula Podcast, I just want to make sure I got Chris Benson on before the current fund ends. And I think it's supposed to end sometime in the next few weeks. So there is an opportunity there if you want to deploy some capital. They have a great structure there. You even have a 9% preferred return. But before you do any of that, I wanted to make sure you heard from Chris Benson. And he is my guest on this week's episode of Wealth Formula Podcast. Chris is the Chief Investment Officer of Reliant Real Estate. And we'll have that conversation right after these messages.
What do the Rothschilds, the Romneys, and the billionaire hedge fund managers know that you don't about growing and protecting wealth? As you might imagine, the wealthy have a few tricks up their sleeves. One strategy allows you to grow wealth tax-free at a compounding rate with no volatility. It protects your money from creditors and lawsuits, and it lets you invest the same money in two different places at the same time. How about that for amplifying wealth? To learn more, go to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula Podcast is Chris Banson. Chris is the Chief Investment Officer of a really strong partner of Wealth Formula, Reliant Real Estate Management, who is in the business of self-storage. Chris, welcome back. I think you've been on the show before, but welcome back to Wealth Formula Podcast.
Appreciate it, Buck. Thank you.
You know, I think it's a good time to sort of review this asset class because I think, this is something that, I think is always kind of lurking out there. It's not sexy. It is not something that people get super excited about. But when you put it in the context of what it is, you just realize it ain't going anywhere and it's probably worthwhile to look into investing in it. Right? Self-storage. So tell us a little bit the story of self-storage as you see it.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Nobody gets super pumped about self-storage. We joke a lot. It's a metal box on a cement pad, right? So, you know, it's not that trophy asset in downtown municipality that everybody feels good about owning. But to your point, it's just been one of those asset classes that has just bumped along forever. I think the attractiveness that most people see with the asset class really has been its recession resiliency. When people ask us, Buck, like, hey, why self-storage? I think there's always three things that we point to that are sort of the foundations of the why behind investing in self-storage. And the first one I already touched on is, you know, through our last two economic cycles, both COVID, the COVID cycle and the GFC before that, self-storage outperformed all other major asset classes, apartments, retail, office, industrial. And so that really brought us to the forefront after the GFC. Like people really started saying, oh, wow, this self-storage thing is a real asset class. And before that, it was very niche-y. The other piece is historically, over the last 28 years, storage has done just under 18% a year, which is pretty incredible when you think about, you know, what we've seen in 20 years. So it's had this really good historical run. And then in these downturn markets has also been really strong. And I think that's what draws most people to it is it's very sticky.
So are you, so what you're saying is that maybe it wasn't drawing as much institutional or large, you know, big money attention until recently. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, call it the last probably 5 to 8 years, it's become much more on the forefront of institutional investors. I would consider us, a quote unquote real asset class in the, in the real estate space now, where Buck, you know, like multifamily and retail, office, industrial have always kind of been the core four of real estate. And we were always very niche-y. And then after the GFC, people saw how the asset class performed and there was a lot more interest from some of the institutional investors, as the asset class has matured.
When you think about self-storage, I think like this is a, it's an area that I think a lot of us can just relate to and understand why there may be resilience in good times and bad times and pretty much any time, right? I mean, whether you're downsizing, whether you're unemployed, getting kicked out of your house or you're just moving, whatever, you just got stuff. You got stuff that has to go somewhere and it sits there. And it's a real pain in the butt to move it. I mean, I'm talking, obviously you can hear that I've dealt with self-storage as a consumer.
How many units do you have right now, Buck?
Well, I mean, in terms of my own personal use?
Yeah.
Well, now I think I'm only down to one. But, you know, I moved several times in the last few years. And, there was stuff sitting there for probably 7 years. And in the meantime, the story, and again, this is funny to talk about because, we've been partners with Reliant and that kind of thing. And we've seen this from the other side. But in the meantime, the self-storage operator can slowly, not so slowly, I should say, raise those rents and know that it is going to take a lot for it to become so painful that you move your stuff out. But isn't that at the core of the business, that is kind of what happens, isn't it? Because if you look at the rate of increases in rents for self-storage, it is a lot higher. And these are not like yearly or, you know, multiple year leases. I mean, so talk a little bit about that, because I think it helps to illustrate the, you know, the inertia that you're using to actually profit.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I think the first thing that you hit on is sort of the demand drivers behind storage. In America, people love stuff and they don't get rid of it, right? That's kind of the bottom line. And that's true in good economic times or in bad economic times. We kind of joke, you know, we catch them on the way up and we catch them on the way down. There's a category, Buck, that we use. We call it the four D's of self-storage demand, and it's death, dislocation, downsize, and divorce. And so if those things are happening in your life, generally you are a consumer of self-storage. And, you know, in a downturn, people are getting downsized and they're moving and things are happening, which is why the asset class has been very sticky. And to your point, they're 30-day leases. So theoretically, we could raise rents every month. We wouldn't have any customers, but, you know, it's different than like office where you're signed up for a 5-year lease or apartments where it's a 12-month lease. So it gives us a lot of flexibility in our pricing, and that can be good and bad, right? I mean, you know, just as quickly rates can go up, they can also go down because they're not locking somebody in. But the interesting part about storage and why I think it's been so successful is it comes down to, like you said, once people are in, they're generally sticky because no one's going to take a weekend and go rent a U-Haul truck for, you know, if you're paying $100 a month and we raise your rent 6%, that sounds like a lot, but that's $6 a month or $72 a year. Most people aren't going to do anything. You know, they're going to say, yeah, whatever. It's not going to make sense. So what happens is, even, and I'll use 2022 as an example, we're down rental rate wise about 20% year over year from 22 to 23. So rental rates are down and the demand for the asset class is down. I would say primarily because housing is down, the transactions, the number of houses being sold is less. But what's interesting is if you look at the public REITs, for example, their revenues, same store revenues are up. And so you ask like, well, how can that be? How can rates be down, but revenues in the stores are up? And the answer is because of that pricing increase that you're talking about. Right. Most of the time, our tenants are carrying the burden of that revenue growth. The revenue growth is coming from the in-place tenants versus new tenants coming in. So even in a market where rates are declining, the tenants are continually seeing that tick up in rental rates, which gives you that long-term revenue growth. So that's kind of the secret sauce behind the asset class. It's why it's been so successful historically, and arguably what we think what will drive that demand moving forward as well.
Reliant is sort of a vertically integrated. And you want to talk a little bit about that and how that works? Because I do think it is it's different. And I think it probably accounts for a lot of the success that you guys have had.
Yeah. At its purest level, vertically integrated just means we're managing the stuff that we're buying. So it's an employee of Reliant who's behind the desk at every one of our storage facilities. And you know, what it ultimately does is we care more.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, when you have a third party manager, I don't mean to say they don't care. They care, but they don't care as much as we care. And so I think it gives us the flexibility to be very nimble in the marketplace and make changes quickly. And because we can control all things from how we're digitally marketing to, you know, the goods that we're placing on the walls to sell based on how they're performing, it allows us to be very nimble. But what I would say about that, Buck, too, is it is evolving. What that management looks like is evolving as technology evolves. Right now, one of the things that we're beta testing is what we would call a virtual counter, where, you know, Buck, typically, you know, you walk into a storage facility, there's a guy or gal behind the desk or a couple of them. And we're testing a virtual model where you walk through the door and you're interacting with a live person just through a screen. And we have 97 properties right now. 9 of our 97 are running that platform, with the hopes to see if we can supplement technology and reduce some of our payroll costs. Yeah. And so I think when we're vertically integrated like that, we can make changes like that quickly, and not rely on other people to make that decision for us.
You know, I think one of the keys, to this, to me at least, is that self-storage is really, I mean, the driver is a business. An underlying thing here is that you've got a business. You're trying to get customers, right? I mean, it is real estate, of course, but it's as much a retail business almost, just like anything else. And that's the importance of, as you said, caring about how things turn out. How has this, I guess, a run-up in rates and inflation and everything that we have experienced in the last 24 months or so, 18 to 24 months, whatever, how has that affected this marketplace? And you know, obviously, we have a pretty good sense. We got kind of, you know, really hurt in the multifamily space. But the flip side of that is, I think we're seeing 2024 as a real potential buying opportunity. You know, self-storage seems to have not really had any, you know, severe downfalls per se. It's always kind of trucking along. Is that about what's kind of the standard, you know, thing that's happening right now? Or tell me what's going on now.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the biggest impact, similar to what you touched on with multifamily, has been the impact of rising interest rates. And that's impacted us too. You know, the cost of our debt service, if we have to go out and get a loan today, is much higher than it was, you know, 18 months ago, as the Fed has continued to raise rates. I think, you know, from a demand side of things, I just touched on it, but, you know, think of what's happening in the world right now. The number of new housing transactions, people are not selling their houses. They're not moving, right? It's expensive to buy a new house. And if I sell mine, even if I make money on it, I got to go put it into something else. So they're just hanging on.
Right.
So housing transactions have fallen off the face of the earth, which, you know, storage, depending on the market you're in, storage is a big, or moving is a big demand driver for self-storage. So we've definitely seen sort of a plateau of kind of rates and occupancy through 2023. Like 2021 and the beginning of 2022 were this huge growth, and then it dipped, and now we've sort of plateaued. So I, like you, think, you know, towards the end of 24, people are just going to normalize, right? Interest rates are what they are. You know, we're going to have to figure out how to buy and sell houses at 7% and 8%, because that's where we're going to be. I don't think we're going to see the Fed cut rates hugely in 24. And so I think that just sort of normalizes, and there'll be some pent up demand there.
Yeah.
But time will tell. But the other piece, Buck, that, you know, the last 18 months has impacted values, where if we were to go sell today, there are certain instances where there's still very strong demand. But I think values between what buyers and sellers want to pay right now, there's still a gap.
Seems to be a sort of across the board, you know, an ongoing issue just in terms of real estate, which is this this gap between the expectation of what sellers want to sell for because they're used to selling for more, and sure, the realities of compressed cap rates, decompressed cap rates, because, you know, the reality of debt, right? You debt really is going to dictate what these capitalization rates are. So in self-storage, you know, tell us a little bit how debt works in self-storage, because it's different. I mean, we're typically dealing with, you know, big, you know, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae type, you know, non-recourse, you know, debt and that kind of thing. These are different types of loans. And tell us about what that market is like and how that in particular has been affected and how you've been able to navigate that.
Yeah, for sure. The biggest difference is there's none of that institutional debt to go get, right? So with projects that we're buying, generally we're working with smaller local regional banks. Sometimes some large banks, and we do larger debt portfolios, but typically we're financing deal by deal with a smaller local lender. And, you know, what I would say, if you had asked 18 months ago, Buck, typically we're trying to target about a 65% loan to value. And today that number, what's really shifted is two things. The pricing is higher. So interest rates are certainly higher, which I think everyone would expect. And then the other thing is lenders have pulled back very much on the amount of debt they're willing to lend. So in our current fund right now, our loan to value is just over 53%. So typically we would take a little bit more debt than that. And the lenders have become much more conservative. Now the upside to that is there's more safety in the deal,
right? Sure.
'Cause you got more equity in every deal. But how we've navigated that, like in our most recent fund, our last two closings, we've seen a pretty strong appetite for seller financing, where you're going to the seller and saying, hey, you want this purchase price. There's no way we can get there. But if you can finance 60% of the deal at this interest rate, then the math starts to make sense. And we've had success with that because, you know, Buck, for the seller, it's kind of nice. It helps defer their tax liability on the profits. And then they have a coupon that they're clipping, you know, moving forward. And the collateral is their project. So if we don't pay them, they just take their own deal back.
Yeah.
So that's been a successful strategy to date. We'll see how things kind of play out as we go into 24.
How much of the acquisitions that you have? I mean, you know, it sounds like obviously if you've got people who are doing seller financing, these sound like maybe they're mom and pops, that kind of thing. But is this still an area where there's, you know, a significant mom and pop presence there? Like, I mean, multifamily, like, you know, you look at like something like DFW that has been, you know, enormous market for the last 20 years. The growth has been crazy there. Yeah, it used to be mom and pops. Those mom and pops took their $7 million properties and sold them for $35 million in the last few years. Is that a thing still in self-storage, the mom and pop thing?
Yeah, very much so. The market is still very fragmented relative to multifamily, right? If you pick up multifamily, it's a much more institutionalized asset class. So the data is wishy-washy. You can't really get a hard handle on it, but somewhere between 30 and 35% of the market is owned by the five publicly traded REITs, right? The big institutional players. And then there's another 20% that's owned by groups like us. Mm-hmm. We would be considered like a regional operator. Reliant is the 17th largest operator in the US, right? Just to kind of give you a sense of the scale. But then there's another 50% that the statistic I like best is 50% of the square footage in the US is owned by operators who own five or less facilities. So that's what we would consider mom and pop. And so Buck, what that provides opportunities for a group like us is a roll-up strategy or consolidation where we're, you know, we're buying the smaller mom and pops, rolling them up into a larger portfolio. And as we started the conversation, there's institutional investors who are looking to deploy larger checks and need that portfolio level transaction to do it. So still a lot of fragmentation in the space.
So what you've got is in your model too, like effectively, it's almost like a roll-up model, right? Roll-up private equity model where, like, you know, you buy a bunch of small businesses and then roll them up and you create efficiencies and put it under one umbrella and you sell it for a bigger multiple. That's effectively what you're doing in these funds.
Yeah. Think of it this way. In institutional money, you know, if I'm a pension fund or an endowment or, you know, a foundation and I have $1 billion that I'm trying to put to work in self-storage, they decide that the asset class is right. Well, they can't go out and build their own portfolio. It will take too long and they don't have the manpower to do it. So they're trying to find portfolios that they can deploy a big check size. And historically, at least, we'll see how it plays out in the future. They've paid a premium for those larger deals because there aren't many of them out there. And so
will they want you to manage them, Chris? They'll want Reliant to continue managing them, presume.
Some cases, yes. There are some situations where, you know, they'll partner with like one of the REITs and they'll be the equity backing and bring them in third party management. But we have certainly had institutional capital come in and then retain Reliant on the management side, which works out great for everybody.
Yeah. Interesting. Tell us a little bit, I guess, about the current fund that you have right now. What's in there? How is it structured? all that. We've, you know, obviously been promoting it a little bit on our end because I do think it's a it's a very compelling play right now, in my opinion, given the fact, as you've pointed out, we're talking about low leverage. We're talking about you can get to a 9% pref and all these kinds of things in an asset class that is traditionally extremely stable. So maybe you can add sort of your perspective on that fund. What is it called? Tell us that.
Yeah, Reliant Self Storage Fund 4. So, Buck, we used to syndicate individual deals, and then in 2019 we started launching individual funds. So, you know, for your listeners, just think of like a mutual fund versus a stock.
Let me stop you there for 1 second, because just as a reminder, we did I think 3-4 deals together, Reliant and Wealth Formula as a credit investor group, and I don't think we hit anything below 30% annualized return. We had one where we literally doubled within 9 months. So this has been a very good ride for our investors, by the way. So, well, anyway, the fund is great. I would love to go back to some of those individual things too, but I wanted to give some context so people understand why I'm an advocate for what you're doing right now, but go ahead. What are you doing now?
Yeah. So we're on our fourth fund, and, you know, the idea behind the fund is just to provide some more diversification for investors. They go in and, you know, they have ownership in the fund, which right now we have 9 properties in the fund across 4 states, mostly here in the Southeast. And, you know, what I like about the fund is what you had touched on is we're delivering kind of, or projecting to deliver mid-teens type of returns with debt that's at 53% loan to value. So pretty conservative on the debt side with still pretty decent returns. And if anything comes back to us in the marketplace, you know, we project it to be a 6-year hold. So it's a pretty long window. Mm-hmm. And if debt comes back to us in the marketplace, either, you know, interest rates come down a little bit or lenders are willing to lend a little bit more, gives us a really nice opportunity to refinance, return some of the capital to investors and really cash flow well. And although we don't project that in the fund, we're in a nice position to do that. So, you know, I think it's hard, Buck, and I'm sure you hear this too, where people are just asking, you know, is now the right time? And the answer is, I don't know. You know, we never know where the bottom is. And our best course of action has always been, you know, make good decisions today on the information we have and try to be conservative in our underwriting. And, you know, typically that plays out well. Timing the market has been very challenging. If you look at the data in the last 20 years, either in the equities market or real estate, it's really hard to know, all right, now's the time to pull the trigger. So
Yogi Berra said, it's very hard to make predictions, especially about the future. But I think the thing that to understand here, which I think makes this appealing in my opinion, is this is an area without a lot of volatility to begin with. I mean, it's just, there's just not a lot of volatility. It's boring from soup to nuts. You know, it's like you don't have a lot of a movement in terms of, you know, there's rock bottoms or, you know, whatever. It has been a space that has been very, very stable. And, you know, to your point about rates, the one thing that people forget, and I think is worth noting, is that the number of people who've made money, a lot more money than they would have expected, because they bought when rates were high and then rates went back down, is enormous. I mean, you talk to anybody who's been, you know, investing in real estate for 20, 30 years, they'll tell you the times when they made the most amount of money is when they bought in a high rate environment and then things went, you know, to a low rate environment. So that there's a certain element of buying within that. Effectively, you're buying low leverage, sure, which is safe, because you're buying in a high interest environment. And you're still projecting mid-teens. You're giving a pref of 9%, which basically, I mean, it's not a guarantee by any means, but it's a very healthy pref in a very stable space. That if you just imagine for a moment, like every economist and their mother is predicting a turnaround in rates over the next, 18 months, 12 to 24 months, let's say, that turns into something potentially really, not boring anymore, I mean, who's to say like mid-teens are not exactly boring returns, but I mean, we're kind of spoiled, right? We're kind of spoiled. And so to that extent, this could quickly turn around and, if rates come down a little bit, really surprise people. So it's a win and potentially bigger win.
Yeah, I think, Buck, it's hard, right, as investors too, and you know this and probably many of your listeners, we've experienced the last 10 years, everything's just gone up. Right. Yeah. And we've had some really outsized returns. And I think we're, it's a much easier market to do that when money is free. And now money is not free. And so there's going to be, I think, an adjustment. And I think we all have to reset our expectations, which is part of it. And then I think, like you said, you buy when it's stormy, right? When no one wants to buy is when you want to be out there transacting, because one, your competition is less, and two, everything's cyclical. It's scary now, but 2 years from now, is it still scary? Mm-hmm. Probably not. If you look at the historical cycles of our economy in the last 50 years, you kind of have these 18-month, 24-month type bumps, and then things start to come back. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But I, like you, think that everything is cyclical, and even in these downturns, when you're buying good deals, when the market comes back, usually you benefit the most from it.
Yeah, it's usually that time when people don't have the appetite. When you, in hindsight, mm-hmm. do you look back and say, gosh, I wish we'd bought. I mean, I was talking to one of my multifamily partners on this from CAF, and he brought up an interesting idea, and I think it's probably true that that we're kind of entering this period that resembles 2012, because we've experienced significant distress, on multifamily and certainly like a lot of the real estate space has, even if it hasn't felt like 2008, 2009, because there wasn't as much, maybe carnage on Wall Street. There certainly was in the real estate market, and still there's fallout from that. But he put the parallel out there to 2012, when it looked like, maybe it's a good time to buy now, but a lot of people were too scared to do it. And then in hindsight, this is a time, if you bought back then, you're making money hand over fist.
Well, and credit markets tighten, right? So it's harder to do it.
Right.
Lenders don't want to lend. Right. And that's where we're at today, right? Is lenders have pulled back. They're very conservative, even with, good balance sheet buyers. But the credit markets have tightened, so there's less people buying. And like you said, Warren Buffett says it, right? You buy when everybody else is afraid, and usually that turns out in the long term. What it is, Buck, too, and you probably have good perspective on this, is I think we think in too short of windows. Our wealth and wealth creation is sort of a forever game, right? The horizon is your whole life. And if you can think with longer term goals, generally, I like the quote, everything's a good deal in 20 years in real estate, right? I mean, I'm 43. Anything I bought when I was 23, it's worth a lot more today. And that could be any asset class.
Right.
And so I think that's part of it, too, is just letting time do its thing, as long as you're making good decisions on the front end.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, going back to this fund, which, by the way, people can learn more about that. I think we have ReliantFund4.com. That's right. Mm-hmm. And you can spell that out. You can put the number there, whatever you want. ReliantFund4.com. And check out the webinar that we did with Chris and the team over there. Again, this is a very reasonable place to deploy. And certainly consider talking to Chris about this more. I mean, again, it is like, right now, 9% with potential significant upside on top of that is a very reasonable consideration, in my view, given where we are, given the track record of Reliant, given the track record of this space. By the way, if you want to talk about the track record of Reliant, I don't think we even talked about that, because that's kind of a pretty impressive thing, too. I mentioned what we did together, which is, you know, I don't even know what those numbers were, but they were stupid numbers, but go on.
Yeah. We've had a good run, Buck. I mean, it's always hard too, right? What I just said, like, hey, we have to recalibrate what we think good returns are, but Reliant has had a lot of success in taking deals full cycle. We've taken 38 deals full cycle. Most importantly, have never lost investor principal. But our average equity multiple on those 38 deals is just over 2.5. So if you had invested $100,000, basically returned 2.57 at the project level in just over 3 years. So it was a really, really good time. And you know, if you were looking at our deck right now, you'd see a disclaimer on the bottom that says, you know, previous results don't mean that that's what we're going to see in the future. But I think it speaks to, one, the asset class, and two, the team, right? We have a team that is intimately familiar with the asset class and been doing it a long time. And so both us and our investors have been the beneficiary of that. And I still think there's value in the market, but, you know, I think of those numbers, like you said, stupid numbers, like those are triple and home run kind of numbers. I think there's a probably
you never project in the next those, cycle. Right? You never project those. And if you end up, hey, listen, if all of a sudden rates end up going down to, you know, the mortgage rates end up going down, you know, sub 4, then the next thing you know, you are in stupid number land again. You know, it just does become that. You can't predict that. You never should invest based on that, but it is worthwhile at least mentioning. So, Chris, it's been great having you on the show again. ReliantFund4.com. Anything else worth mentioning before we cut out here?
No, I think we're just to wrap up, we're at an interesting time in the cycle. And whether you're looking at us or any other asset class, I think you just got to think long term. And if it's scary now, it's probably going to be a benefit in the future.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being on. We'll love to have you on again soon.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks, Buck.
Be right back. Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. And again, lots of opportunities coming up this year. So, you know, if self-storage is not your cup of tea, that's cool. But I want to make sure that we had an opportunity to at least have Chris Benson on to talk about it, as this fund itself is closing in probably just a few weeks. So, hopefully you've at least learned about something. Whether or not you invest, completely up to you. I also want to remind you before we leave, this is another year in which we have this other podcast called Sapia with Buck Joffrey. And as the years go by, you may need that podcast more and more because it really focuses in on longevity and health. There's some wisdom in there as well, but right now we're going heavy longevity and health. But that's it for me this week on Wealth Formula Podcast. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapia with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.